You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on October the 21st, the first day officially of the cycling off-season, because there is nothing left to watch and there are exactly 100 days until elite racing resumes in Mallorca with the Trofeo Calvia. My name is Daniel Freiber and I am in Mallorca with the Archduke of this island as far as cycling is concerned. The voice of cycling throughout the world, Mr. Rob Hatch. Rob, first of all, you see that a lot in Mallorca, a lot of talk about the Archduke. Who was the Archduke?
I have no idea. I thought it was John Janeiro's when he was talking about that. Then somebody really famous from Mallorca.
Yeah,
by the way, your little comment about racing there, I hope the Aussies aren't listening.
Well, did I say? I mean, I meant the European season. Sorry, I didn't insert that. But that is what I meant. 100 days. Does that seem a lot? Does it seem a little? We're going to be talking about the off season, how we feel about the off season in just a while. But 100 days, Rob.
For now, right now, doesn't feel like enough because we've got to go on holiday first. But I think in a month or so, we'll be ready for it to kick off again, won't we?
Hopefully. Today's podcast, it's going to be very much an off-season kind of vibe, isn't it, Rob? Very off-season sort of mood at the Cycling Podcast, sort of at remote headquarters, which are in Mallorca.
I should set the scene, actually, because I'm sat on the terrace here.
Where are we?
Well, we're on my terrace in my flat. We're looking up at the Sierra de Alfabia.
Where did the Archduke
might be in an olivar somewhere.
Yes.
At the top there.
Anyway, describe the Sierra. What is the Sierra of Alfabia?
It's a part of the famous Sierra de Tramontana. And Alfabia is a small part of that. The mountains behind Soia.
The Table Mountain of Soia.
Well, yeah, we've actually walked up to the top, haven't we?
And yes.
We tried to get across, but we were denied access with a locked gate. There's the Soia space station up on the hill there. The antennas, they're the TV antennas that provide the television signal to the whole of the Balearic Islands. But it's a pretty nice autumn afternoon. The sun's shining. I'm sat down here on a beanbag on the other side of the terrace. You're there on the nice chair. You've got a coffee on the go. You've got the greatest mineral water known to man, Vichy Catalan, which is there as well. Shame we're not sponsored by them, really, isn't it?
We should be.
But you're there, and you're just sort of soaking up the rays,
yeah.
Microphone in hand, and it's a relaxed affair.
Yeah, trying to squeeze out the last droplets of energy and insight, even less insight than energy, I fear, of the cycling season. And we'll be with you over the next hour or so. Rob, of course, this is a part of the world that will be very familiar to a lot of amateur cyclists. This is a bit of a mecca, isn't it? A bit of a very familiar destination. Soia itself. You just talked about the mountain on one side of us, sort of just around the corner. There's an even more famous mountain in Mallorca, Puig Mayor, which is one of the more famous climbs. The road that goes sort of not quite over, but kind of through the top, is one of the more famous climbs in Mallorca, isn't it?
Yeah, that's where you get to the tunnel, and you go over, and if you've been here, you'll see the military zone where there's a big radar station that was put up there back in the days when NATO was, you know, its height, I guess, in just after the Second World War. There's one of those big golf ball listening posts on the top up there. A couple of reservoirs are up there as well.
And one of the great, I'm not going to call it a tragedy, but I will call it a travesty of cycling, amateur cycling, road access in Europe is the fact that there is a pretty good road. I think I've seen it on videos. I think Frank Schleck went up there a couple of years ago, was it? And he was doing some publicity for Mavic. But the road that goes right to the top of Puig Mayor, to sort of 1,400 metres above sea level, which would be clearly the highest road in Mallorca, is closed. And does it open once a year? Is it accessible?
There's been a couple of staged events in the last couple of, and it's always fallen sort of during the spring classics when I'm away, actually. So I've never had the chance to do it, but I know people have walked up there, they've ridden up there, but it's a military zone, so you have to have permission from the Ministry of Defence to open it. But I think they're starting to make the odd agreement with certain organisers who are opening it, and the views up there look stunning.
You and I have talked about the distant, impossible dream of a Sacalobra, which is another very famous climb in Mallorca. a time trial maybe in a big stage race, maybe in the Vuelta a España, it would be very difficult to organise. Might involve boats, mightn't it? Yes,
probably have to get on the boat down here in Puerto de Soya and go all the way across. That you might see the Riders' Union kicking up about that one, maybe. Yeah.
In case anyone hadn't already guessed, this is going to be a slightly rambling episode.
I thought you were going to say, in case anybody hadn't already switched off, this is going to be a slightly rambling
Well,
episode.
Rob, there has still been our future. In our future, there's not much. In our immediate future, there's not much racing. But that has been in the immediate past. Over the last week, there has still been some racing all over the world. In fact, and as tradition dictates, we will now proceed to give a bit of a roundup of what has been happening. Rob, we'll start sort of arbitrarily with the stage race. The Tour of Guangxi concluded at the weekend, and with it, the World Tour, the men's elite World Tour season. The winner was Lennart van Etveld of Lotto Destiny, largely by virtue of having taken the Queen's stage to Nongla. Second on GC was Oscar Onley of DSM Firmenich Post NL. Third was Alex Bourdin of Decathlon Agence d'Auxerre La Mondiale. Stage winners were Lionel Terminiot, Wara van Herover, Ethan Vernon again, Van Etveld again, and, well, as we'd already said, Van Etveld, and Mateusz Govekar. Took the final stage.
He's had a really good end of the year, actually. I think he won the last stage at the Tour of Britain as well, so he's making a bit of a thing of winning the last stage.
Was that in a bunch sprint?
It was.
There was also a women's Tour of Guangxi, only a one-day race, that one. That was won by Sandra Alonso of Spain and Sarah Tizit.
Big breakaway. 40-odd kilometres, I think she was away.
There was also, Rob, well, this was preceded by the Tour of Chongming Island, also in China. That was three stages long, and the GC there went to Marta Lach, I think, of Seratizit again. Remaining in Asia, we had another traditional season closer with the Japan Cup. That was won for the second time by Nielsen Paulus of EF Education Easy Post. No doubt Nelson Paulus now is becoming a bit of a folk hero in Japan. I don't know if you've ever heard riders talk, Rob, about the reception they get there. We've had, I think maybe Joe Dombrowski told the story on the podcast once that he got his own sort of Japanese nickname. I think there were sort of like Barbie dolls of Joe Dombrowski that were made and sold.
I've been to Japan for work before. I went back on holiday this year for the first time in over a decade, and I love the place. I mean, the manners, the respect, the culture is so, so different than anything we expect in Europe. And I guess that if Nielsen Paulus wins one more, it'll be bigger than the Beatles in Japan.
Indeed. In Europe, talking of people who are bigger than the Beatles, Rob, in Europe, the curtain came down on the men's season with something we call the Settimana Pozzatiana, run, organised by Pippo Pozzato, the first and only Italian Beatle. That sort of three-race series, there's also a social ride as well, but that comprises the Giro del Veneto, the Serenissima Gravel, and the Veneto Classic. Rob, you were commentating on the Giro del Veneto. The Serenissima Gravel was unfortunately curtailed because of bad weather. You were also commentating on the Veneto Classic. Tell us what happened in those two races, Giro del Veneto and Veneto Classic, briefly, Rob, because we're going to discuss them maybe in a bit more detail in part two. Who won?
Corbin Strong took the victory ahead of Sandro Meris and Romain Grégoire on a rainy day in Vicenza, just outside of Vicenza, up the hill there. Beautiful finish, by the way, that I think we'll get into a little bit afterwards. Reminds me of Giro dell'Emilia, the way it finishes up there. And then in the Veneto Classic, it was a day-long breakaway. Six in the breakaway, and the lone survivor was Magnus Cort with a fantastic win to finish the season. And it was one of those, will he, won't he? Brilliant way to end the season, really. And, you know, motivation's not always there, even for some of you viewers sometime. You know, there's a certain extent, I think, of maybe being fatigued and fed up and wanting a break. But no, it was entertaining to the final pedal stroke and a brilliant win for Magnus Cort.
It was, Rob. We also, talking of entertainment, we also had the World Track Championships, my favourite event of the year.
Oh, you love it, don't you?
That also happened, apparently, at the weekend. The Netherlands topped the medal table. A few weeks ago, Rob, we had a discussion about how medal tables are calculated. You set me right on that. And Netherlands did top the medal table. There were lots of notable individual performances, well, individual and team performances, but Rob, some highlights.
Harry Laveresen, a 16th world title now, and alongside Chris Hoy, He's the only man now to have won just about every discipline that you can win in sprinting. So he's an absolute superstar, is Harry Lavresen. Where does he go next? What does he do next? It's difficult to achieve more, Harry Lavresen. Elsewhere, there's another world title in the Madison for Roger Kluger, this time with Tim Thorn-Teutenberg, so a switch of partners. In that same Madison race, it was a goodbye for Michael Mirko. He retired from the sport. Julie Lett retired as a world champion as well. She'd come back this year and she won the women's Madison with Amelie Diederichsen. And in individual pursuiting among the men, world record broken twice. Josh Charlton earlier in the day. That took away a world record that had been set by Filippo Ganna. And then, with Italy seeing that the world record had been snatched away, in the final they duly took it back. Ganna away at the Worlds, not racing. He was off on holiday, having had a really busy year. So it was big Jonathan Milan who did the job to bring it back. And yeah, a fantastic brand new world record.
Rob,
there.
Was it a fast track? He says, sounding as though he knows what he's talking about.
Evidently was fast enough to break some world records.
Was the atmosphere very fast that day? That sometimes happens as well, doesn't it?
Apparently so.
Low pressure in the velodrome.
Yeah, the atmosphere. Yeah. I thought you were talking about the crowd then. But yes, the atmosphere all contributes to it. And I think we'll have to take you to track school someday. Let's go to Japan. Let's go to Kieran school, shall
we? I did that once. I was expelled. Rob, you mentioned Chris Hoy. Some very, very sad news about Chris Hoy, the six-time Olympic track champion at the weekend. He revealed in an article in the Sunday Times that his cancer is terminal, and he has an estimated 2 to 4 years left to live. He was diagnosed last year after experiencing shoulder pains. The primary cancer was in his prostate, and that has now spread to his bones and other areas. He's been undergoing chemotherapy since November and made the terminal diagnosis public after a journalist inquired about his health. Chris is also working on a memoir in which he'll detail his experiences over the last few months. That's going to be entitled All That Matters, My Toughest Race Yet. Rob, needs to say, all our thoughts go to Chris and his family. Obviously, I think a lot of the listeners will know Chris was very close to our late great leader, Richard Moore, who also collaborated on a couple of books, I think, with Chris Hoy. And you also know Chris well. You've worked with him.
Yeah, not particularly well, but again through Richard, really, and through work, and like everybody, absolutely devastated. I mean, I don't think you can meet a nicer human being, full stop, never mind in cycling. And you mentioned Richard. Chris was actually one of the first people who was in touch after we got the news about Richard, and yeah, just knocked for six by it all, Daniel. Knocked for six by it.
Yep. Rob, back on the road, there have been a number of transfers that have been announced, lots more that have also been rumoured, but some that have been announced over the last week or so. Mike Tournison is going from Intermarché Wanty to Astana. Clément Champoussin is going from Arkea B&B Hotels to Astana. Dan McClay, that was a surprise. That was a left field one from Arkea to Visma Lisebike, apparently as a lead out man for Olaf Coy. Max Walker, Astana to EF Education First. Gianni Moscon, another surprising one maybe for a lot of people, from Sudal Quickstep to Red Bull.
Musical saddles for Gianni Moscon, isn't it, at the minute?
Milan Varda from Visma Lisebike to Q36.5. Alexander Kamp from Tudor to Intermarché. Gianmarco Garofoli from Astana to Sudal Quickstep. There have been a couple of others, but those were the main ones. Rob, Astana, very active. Mm. And if one casts a glance at the running league table, the running UCI rankings from the last 2 years, one starts to understand why. Why for the last 2 years, or over the last 2 years? Because, of course, we now have these three-year promotion and relegation cycles. Next year is the final year of the current promotion and relegation cycle. And to put it bluntly, Astana are in desperate need of points, aren't they, Rob? Because they are in 21st position. So they are, well, three spots adrift of safety.
If you were looking at the football league table, and apologies to any US listeners, anybody who's not too interested in football, soccer, they're in the relegation zone, essentially. And, you know, it's the sort of point.
What's that, Rob?
All right, Ron. Whereas it's sort of, imagine we're two-thirds of the way through the season here. We are, because it's a three-year year season, in inverted commas. And I know it's not that easy to understand. I think this is something going forward, and I think we'll talk about this next season, really, but something that the UCI needs to sort of create a better narrative around. Because the three-year narratives, it's a hard follow, isn't it? It's a hard watch. But essentially, imagine we're two-thirds of the way through the season, and maybe it's time to get Big Sam in. It's time to get Sam Allardyce in to keep you up, or in the cycling equivalent as that is sign somebody who can score you lots of goals, lots of points. And that is what teams are scrambling around to do, as well as Astana Kazakhstan, also in the relegation at the minute, RKF B&B Hotels. There seems to be a bit of a strange exodus there going on at the minute. They're not exactly in the business of announcing signings who are going to come in and bring them points. More on announcing graduates from their development team up to the first team. So it sounds as though if the team is going to carry on, and if there's nothing else untoward happening in the background, then maybe they're starting to cut their cloth accordingly and think of the finances and promote from below.
I mean, even their team management has been in the press suggesting, hinting very strongly that 2025 is going to be the last year for that team if things do not change, particularly on the sponsorship front. They need more funding, to put it bluntly, don't they, Rob? And what you've just said makes a lot of sense, cutting some of the higher earners already in anticipation of next year being their last year, which would be sad.
And on the other opposite front to that, just below RKM B&B Hotels in the table, it's just a question of a few points. You've got UnoX Mobility. Just below them, as well as Astana, you've got Total Energy and Tudor. And they're the teams who are sort of on the way up. They're trying to get promoted. So you've got to imagine this, that, you know, the top division and the second division are actually on the same league table. And it's the points they get between them that then sorts out the new league table for the next 3 years. And we should also mention, if we're talking about the teams who are in the trouble, looking very good for promotion at the minute are IPTs, Royal Premier Tech, and Lotto Destiny, because they are very much, let's say, mid-table mediocrity, aren't they?
Well, Lotto Destiny almost looks safe.
Yes.
They are in ninth position currently in the rankings, and it would take something quite remarkable for them to fall out of those top 18 positions, wouldn't it, by this time next year? Yeah. But Rob, as I think you said in your commentary at the weekend at the Veneto Classic, that
someone
could
was listening
be
then.
Well, that could be a humdinger next year. It was already a humdinger. We'll talk about it in the next part, but it could be very, very important. Next year could be a nail biter. Akea might be saying goodbye to the World Tour, saying goodbye to existence, in fact. A couple of retirements I noted down to mention. Dan Bigham retired at the
Europe. Retired with a World bronze Track medal in the individual pursuit.
Yes. Also at the World Track Championships, Mika Morku retired as well. Of course, famous lead out man on the road. And in Guangxi, Gorka Izagirre retired as well. Well, he's been at an assortment of teams over the years, hasn't he, Rob? Real stalwart of the Spanish peloton.
He has. He's been in several different. He's sort of followed his brother at times to Bahrain, and then latterly to Cofidis, both at Movistar as well. And some solid results in his career, Gorka Izagirre. A little bit older than I'd thought. I didn't realise he was 37. It's the sort of thing that you always take a check on when you're doing your research for the next year in the winter, and then suddenly they're a year older and you hear these announcements. And yeah, Gorka Izagirre. We're all getting old, Daniel. Dearie me.
We certainly are, Rob. Rob, any other business? I've got a few things noted down, sort of miscellany of the news roundup. It's a broad church. You can say whatever. You can contribute anything you like in this section. Rob, a couple of interesting stories that caught my eye. The talk is gathering momentum about the salary cap. The UCI have commissioned a study by Coopers, looking into the implications of a possible salary cap, the various different options on the table. In American sports, you have different sort of flavors of salary cap. You have some, I think, in baseball that involve, for example, a bit of a luxury tax where you can go over the salary cap, but you pay a penalty, which is then redistributed to the teams that respect the rules. And then in other sports, you have, as I say, sort of different forms of salary cap. Of course, in professional cycling, one thing that really, really complicates things is the fact that riders live all over the world, teams are registered in different places, and in particular, and this is also, well, it relates, or an article a very interesting article in L'Equipe last week relates to this, and this is something we've known for a long time, but it's not often talked about, that the tax liabilities in France, for example, are much more onerous than they are in other countries, and also the employment laws. So professional cyclists have a different status in France. They're full-time employees of the companies, whereas in other countries they're more like freelancers on retainers.
Yeah, and the onus in certainly the traditional nations where cycling grew up, I would say, you know, Belgium, France, Italy, Spain, even if they were self-employed, the onus would then be on them to pay a lot more national insurance and things like that than it would be, something I've found out when I've come to Spain the last few years, than it would be on the employer. So, I mean, you wouldn't really, even if it was that way, you wouldn't get too many people signing for those teams because it would cost them money out of their own pocket to pay things like that. So it is complicated, and I understand where it's coming from. And certainly when you look at the article you mentioned, the basis for that really was Groupama losing Lenny Martinez. You had a couple of other French riders, really talented French riders leaving. One was Axel Zingler leaving Wyn Cofidis, I think.
Apparently when talking to the L'Equipe journalist, Marc Madiot practically picked up the sort of his handset and threw it across the room.
Did he?
When he was asked, in a sort of typical flamboyant, demonstrative Marc Madiot sort of mocking indignation, when he was asked how come they weren't able to re-sign Lenny Martinez, he couldn't even compete. Sacre bleu.
Well, one of the headlines was what they call in French disloyal competition, sort of unfair competition, if you like. So I can see where it comes from. But if you want to implement those sorts of laws, rules, I guess they would be, given that this is about rules that govern a sport, there'd be legal challenges, wouldn't there? Because you've got so many different, as you say, certainly in Europe, where you've got lots of more labour charges, national insurance charges, obligations to the state in terms of tax, rules about employment laws. You know, teams registered in various countries with different legal and tax systems. I know the European Union does help to sort of bring a lot of rules together, but in terms of taxation and things, and I would say protection and employment laws pretty similar throughout Europe. That's one of the things the European Union's managed to achieve. But in terms of tax status, you and I know that. We've lived in different countries and different obligations and always compared notes of what you've had to do, which form you've had to queue up for, when you've had to pay, things like that. They're very, very different still. They're very different. And I don't see where we can find a solution to it unless somebody's going to, all the teams are going to be registered in one place. But surely that's not going to happen either.
Yeah, no, it is going to be a tricky one. And a lot of us sort of instinctively balk at the idea of there are very attractive things about the idea of a salary cap, but then when you start to analyse it in more detail, it becomes a bit more difficult, doesn't it? But one thing to say, obviously this topic of conversation seems more and more relevant, is in even sharper focus, particularly given, you know, what's happened over the last few weeks, and we've talked about it sort of ad nauseum on the podcast, the domination of one rider, and then it comes into very sharp focus. One thing I would say, rightly or wrongly, the presence of the strongest rider in the world, the most dominant rider in the world in a team has always sort of made it a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that then becomes, that team gets better and better and better because they attract bigger sponsors, more money, and more riders want to go there. And that's what we're seeing now with Tadej Pogacar. The one difference, I suppose, is that the multiples in terms of the budgets of the top teams are different from what they were in terms of percentage. Maybe the richest teams in the world and their budgets are now 100%, 150% what a sort of mid-ranking team is, whereas maybe once upon a time they were more like 50% larger than a mid-ranking team. That has changed.
But that's also a bit of an example of what's happening in the real world as well.
You know, and in sport in general.
Inequality is absolutely huge. It's certainly in our sort of lifetimes, it's the biggest it's ever been, isn't it?
Rob, a couple of other things I wanted to mention. Oh, another big transfer, but this time a coach from the world of triathlon, Olaf Alexander Bue, who we've talked about a lot in the podcast, coach Kristen Blumenfeldt, the preeminent triathlete of his generation, Norwegian triathlete. Of course, there was a story a few weeks ago about him wanting to try his luck as a professional cyclist with the goal of maybe one day winning the Tour de France. A lot of people mocked Blumenfeldt and the very idea that he could come across from triathlon and become a force in professional cycling, not least because he doesn't really look like your typical kind of stage race rider. However, after rumours that Olaf Alexander Boo, his coach, and Blumenfeld were both going to end up representing, being employed by Jaco Alula. Blumenfeld has canned the idea to become a professional cyclist, apparently, for the moment. But Olaf Alexander Boo is going to coach, he's going to be the head of performance for Uno X Mobility next year, which is going to be really interesting. I know our good friend, the Motown Maestro, Lucky Larry Warbass, is a big fan of Olaf Alexander Boo, and he, well, as well as a lot of other people, is a very avid follower of, there's a lot, of, you can find a lot of interviews and content on YouTube, Olaf Alexander Boo talking about his very innovative methods.
Does that mean that Larry, as we speak, instead of being on holiday, is actually either in Denmark or Norway getting a passport?
Then Do you know what? Larry and I discussed this. Because Warbass is a Danish name, apparently.
Wow.
And I suggested that we fabricate together a story about his long lost ancient Norse great grandfather, which would make him eligible for a contact at Uno X. However, that is not going to be the case.
He's
not going to ride for Uno X Mobility next year. However, after my impassioned plea last week that someone somewhere, some World Tour team hopefully, would offer Larry a contract for next year, I've got a good feeling in my bones, Rob, about Larry in 2025. I've just got a good feeling. Talking of friends of the podcast, very good friends of the podcast, final thing I'll mention in the news roundup this week, I know a lot of the listeners have been concerned about the health of Gianni Savio over the last year or so. We visited Gianni at home, of course, during the Giro d'Italia. He'd been laid up for about a year with assorted health issues, and he told us about them then. I should inform the listeners that I spoke to Gianni a few days ago and he's doing a lot better. He's not really back on his feet, out and about yet, but that is no longer looking like a distant prospect. Hopefully, in the coming weeks, Gianni will be starting his outdoor rehab. He's already started his indoor rehab, but all of our best wishes to Gianni.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Well, Rob, we're back.
Where have we been?
With something between a bang and a whimper. I don't know.
I'll just lean back in this sunshine. Hang on.
Yeah. We are back. Rob, this is sort of the golden shoulder, as I call it, of the cycling season, isn't it? Or the year, as far as we're concerned, as we've already said. Start of the off-season. We're going to be talking a bit more in a few minutes about what the off-season brings for us, but well, we heard in the news roundup there was plenty of racing over the weekend. Rob, your last commentary gigs of the season, Giro del Veneto and Veneto Classic. Good races.
They were quite unexpected, actually, because they'd gone off my programme. And then I was ill for Lombardy, which hurt me a lot, by the way, because that's the first time in 17 years I've ever had to miss a broadcast. Completely lost my voice. Which I'm sure after
that,
hearing me far too much this year.
No, I can verify that. You sent me a few pretty croaky sounding messages. Yeah.
But to be honest, there were probably a lot of people who've watched a lot of cycling this year pretty happy to hear a different voice. So that was fine. So I didn't do Lombardy, but there was suddenly the rights came in and the races came in. So yeah, it was nice to actually finish doing a couple of races actually rather than finish with a winter and a DNS. Didn't feel good that, Daniel. But the races were interesting, weren't they, in the Veneto? I was just remarking to you, I think, when we saw each other last night, we caught up again, that the Giro del Veneto, the traditional of the two races on the road that are organised by Filippo Bozzato. I think we probably should tell everyone that's the race that's been around for 80-odd editions now. Over a century.
87, it's been, I think.
Yeah, but over a century it's existed. I mean, it went away for a hiatus of around, I think, 11 years before it came back. And then the Veneto Classic, which is now the season-ending race that finishes in on that wonderful bridge in Bassano del Grappa. Well, that's a brand new race. And that's a race that involves a bit of gravel, cobbles, sort of very much made in Filippo Pozzato's image.
Yeah, inspired by Flandrian races and also by his association with Flanders Classics as well.
But the Giro del Veneto, I think, Daniel, even though that unfortunately this year, rather like in the race I'm going to compare it to in a minute, we didn't see enough because of the weather. It was pretty miserable weather, wasn't it? But the finish they have there now, that should be the modern identity of the Giro del Veneto. The finish on Monte Berico, going out of Vicenza, you've got the porticos, the arches all the way up there. I mean, there's not 666 of them like there are in Bologna. And it's not the Giro d'Emilia, it's a completely different race. But it's a wonderful circuit, some great racing on it. It keeps us guessing right until the last lap, and three editions we've had finishing there have all been like that now. And this year it finished with a little bit of a sprint. I just think the location there is stunning, Daniel. It's absolutely stunning. And on a nice sunny day like it was a couple of years ago, what a location, what an emblem for the race.
Yeah, starting to find their identity as well, a solid identity in that slot in the calendar. I think there is room for another week after Lombardy. It would be a bit of an abrupt ending to the European season to have Lombardy as the last race, particularly when you've got a lot of riders who are still very much in form. I think what we did see at the weekend was some tired riders. Mark Hirschi, who has been firing on four cylinders for a few weeks now, winning most one day races that he has entered. He looked pretty tired. He still finished fourth. I definitely think that, particularly unfortunately with climate change as well, mid-October is not what mid-October used to be. This year wasn't a particularly good example because there was a lot of bad weather in the Veneto for that week. But a nice little sort of cherry on the cake of the cycling season that was 2024, Rob. And Rob, over the next few weeks, starting not next week, because next week we're going to be talking Tour de France route presentation, but starting the week after that, we are going to be embarking on a long series of reviews of the year, or episodes which together will form some kind of review of the year, and that's going to last over a month. We think six episodes, might be four, might be six, might be eight, but that's going to take us almost until Christmas. So we're not going to look back today on the season that was, Rob. We're going to think more about the off season that will, might be. And Rob, in that light, in that vein, I am going to ask you three key questions about this.
Do I need to revise? I should have revised, shouldn't I, for this?
Well, the first one is a fairly simple one and something we neglected to mention in the news roundup on purpose. Last week, of course, there was a lot of talk, and we thought we might be sitting here on the 21st of October talking about Tom Pidcock's move away from Ineos Grenadiers, possibly to Q36. 0.5 or maybe another team. Of course, Pidcock had been deselected, in his words, before Il Lombardia, and that seemed to signify they were headed for Splitsville, definitively. Decree Nisi.
They were in the divorce court.
Yes, they were. Vince Vaughan and Owen Wilson were about to turn up, a la the opening scene of Wedding Crashers. They were about to start negotiating air miles. Rob, colpo di scena, as they say in Italy. Daniel Benson, our colleague who's been following this story very, very closely, reported over the weekend, I think it was on Friday, that the move we thought was going to materialise, Pidcock moving away, probably to Q36.5, was now off. And Ineos Grenadiers now were going to probably hold Pidcock to his contract and keep him. He would be with them for 2025. Now, my first question to you, Rob, about the closed season is, will Tom Pidcock be an Ineos Grenadiers rider on the 1st of January, and will he represent them next year?
The first, if I'm pressed on hard yes or no, I have to go no, with the caveat that there's obvious wiggle room given the fact that there's time now at the end of the season where people won't see each other for a while, for things to calm down and the heat to go out the situation a bit. He's obviously contracted to them.
Three more years.
Three more years.
So his agent told me this morning. but I think you can read that anyway. That's publicly available information.
It's not long since that deal was renegotiated, actually. I seem to remember either this spring or the spring before there was a renegotiation of that contract. I struggle to see it, given the noises we've seen coming out of the team in the last little while. Let's go back to last week, and it was on my channel, really. It was on the Eurosport Cycle Instagram channel, wasn't it? And we had Geraint Thomas doing one of his podcasts, watch-alongs. I think it was for Lombardy. And he was talking to Laurens de Plus, and they were asked a question, because they often get asked questions in the comments on the Instagram lives and what have you. What's going on? And I thought that was quite revealing. There were a few little phrases there from Geraint, who was being really good and really clever. He was being very diplomatic, but there were a few things he said that did open my eyes, and I know they opened yours as well, because we had a chat about it at the time, didn't we? And one, that they admitted that there was an issue. He said, you know, it's not looking good. And they also hinted at an entourage. They hinted at, you know, people not getting on, and that it was strange. And you know what things are like normally, like in sports teams, people would probably just deny it and get on with it, and everybody would allow them to deny it, because that's the way it works, isn't it? But no, there was a sort of an admission there, so that can't be good for the dressing room, which is already low on morale, isn't it?
There's been another interview today, hasn't there? In the last couple of days, also broadcast on the channel that you usually commentate
for.
Yeah,
this was on the Eurosport Cycling YouTube channel, and it was Ethan Hayter talking to our colleagues at the Track World Championships, explaining why he's left, and not too complimentary about the team he was leaving.
Rob, the Pidcock situation, I think it's going to be difficult for him to find a way, well, for the two parties to set aside their differences now. I believe, I mean, information has been a little bit scarce, a lot of it has come from Daniel Benson. I believe the call to deselect him, in inverted commas, came right from the top. I know we had that line from one of the director sport.
What is the top now, Daniel?
Well, that's what I'm about to say. We had that line on the weekend of Lombardy from Zach Dempster, who's a director sportive, and he said it was a management call, not a performance call. Now, there's a CEO at Ineos Grenadiers, and that's John Allert, but there's also a layer above John Allert. There is Dave Brailsford and Jim Ratcliffe, the team owner. I believe the call came from there, the very top, not to pick Pidcock. Why? Why at that time? We can theorise, hypothesise several different things. Were they scared that he was going to win the race? Would that look particularly bad on the team, given that the team has struggled in recent times? If Tom Pidcock was to win, and then he only to announce a few days later that he was going to leave. Why also, if what we read is true, have these negotiations with Q36.5 run aground? Have Ineos Grenadiers been shocked negatively by some of the reaction, I suppose, on social media, maybe in the traditional media as well, to the prospect of Pidcock leaving? A lot of people sort of saying, well, what's the, you know, this team is just lost its way, if they're losing their biggest asset. And did they then get a little bit scared of the implications of losing Pidcock? I know, again, Daniel Benson's talked about a replacement that they... My understanding is that it certainly wasn't a like-for-like in terms of status replacement. I mean, you only have to sort of look around at the riders that might be available, and there aren't too many obvious candidates of that status. You know, the Pidcock size hole, was it that they didn't think they could fill it? Or I think probably more likely is it comes down to economics. We've also heard that possibly Ineos were facing having to cover some of Pidcock's salary still, even though he was riding for another team. Has that just been or become, is that too unpalatable for them under current conditions? Maybe the calling Q36.5's bluff, and they're saying, right, we're pulling out of the negotiations on these current terms in the hope, expectation that Q36.5 or another suitor will come back with a better offer. We'll pay his whole salary in the end. But yeah, very interesting. You mentioned his entourage there, Rob. I think that's definitely a factor. We've talked about this kind of tight-knit group, of which consists of several people around Pidcock. It's a sort of team within a team. You know, bridges are going to have to be, if that's what is going to happen, bridges will have to be rebuilt with them as well as the rider himself.
It's an entourage that's worked for Pidcock. Whether it works for the team or not, I'm not sure. It's worked for Pidcock throughout his career because he's stuck with it. It's his circle of confidence around him. And I know that the personal relationships that they all have are very, very strong bonds. Mm.
But sometimes it feels like a mountain bike team within a road team. It feels as though
Feels like that kind of rider because I find it difficult to talk about Pidcock and evaluate what he is still. I know he's a tremendous bike rider. He's an immense brand. He's a huge talent. And what he's achieved across the disciplines is absolutely outstanding. When you take his road palmarès in isolation, it's not as impressive as you thought it might be. I'm not saying the potential isn't. The potential is there to come across and really wipe the floor and win a lot of races. And if you're Tom Pidcock, you might, and obviously they'd never admit this, but you might be asking yourself, hang on a minute, I need to go to a team to realise that potential on the road. Is that part of the problem? Do they think they need to be at a different team? There's so many questions that are probably hidden within that sort of tight circle that protects him well. And I think the people around him do a good job around him in sheltering him from a lot of the talk because he's undoubtedly hugely talented. But let's say if Tom Pidcock retired tomorrow, I'd struggle to evaluate what he'd achieved on the road because I don't think he's got anywhere near to achieving everything that he can do. Whether that's in GC, I'm sort of doubting that a little bit. I'm not sure he's that interested in that, to be honest, with the noises you've heard coming out there. I'd certainly love to see him winning more classics. And the sad thing about the last weekend is he was in really good form. He was in the best form that I'd seen him for a long time on the road. And he had started to be a big actor in the one-day races leading up to Lombard. And I think that's the sort of travesty of the end of the season for him and for the team, really. Whoever's made the decision, for whatever reason, we were all and they were all deprived of the opportunity to see him racing.
In short, bluntly, I don't think he's going to be there on the 1st of January.
No. I don't either. However, Ineos have just saved £2 million quid a year by getting rid of Sir Alex Ferguson. You know, there's a bit more money in the pot now.
Yeah. Do you know
Fergie for Pidcock?
Do you know where he won't go? I don't think. And this has been reported. One of the rumours that's been reported in the Belgian press was Tudor might be in the race for him. I don't think he'll go there because they've already signed the same rider effectively twice, Alaphilippe. And he or she. The other thing with Tudor, and I don't know how much this is going to affect the team budget. Rob, a couple of weeks ago, I was sharing articles with you from the Swiss watchmaking press. Tudor, of course, is part of the Rolex, same group as Rolex. But things have not been going too well there over the last few months. There have been stories in the Swiss press about them laying off a lot of people at Tudor over the last few months. It's a very volatile market, from what I can understand, the watch market, and it may well pick up. But this is generally, big fluctuations in the watch market are linked to what's going on in China generally. Yeah. And on that front, there have been some unfavourable developments over the last few months. So I don't think he's going there. And it's also, I'm not suggesting that any particular party is using Tudor to kind of tease out or play them against Q36.5. But Q36.5 are another Swiss team, Pro Conti team. You've got to think that maybe there's a little bit of sort of peering over the fence.
I think anything to do with Pidcock and any future destination has a big thing to do as well with bike brands because he's this multidiscipline star, and this was the issue that really sort of made it quite a thorny beginning to his time in Ineos Grenadiers, wasn't it? You remember that Pinarello didn't make a cross bike when he first moved there, and that was a bit of an issue for them, wasn't it? Obviously road bike company had to make mountain bikes, cross bikes, at least the badges have had to appear on them at some stage. I think if you look back to Pidcock's past and where he came from, just keep an eye on which teams ride specialised bikes, maybe. That's one to keep an eye on.
Second question. I thought we might get through a whole podcast without talking about Tadej Pogacar. However, I got news for you.
Have you?
Because just this weekend, Rob, Tadej Pogacar has jumped on an airplane, I think. And that reminds me, actually, I heard at the weekend, Mark Hirschi, who is leaving UAE Team Emirates, he's well known within that team for getting the train to almost every race. Doesn't really fly, not because he's scared of flying, but loves to take the train. I don't know if it's for environmental reasons or just...
Swiss trains are great, aren't they? They get everywhere.
Anyway, Tadej Pogacar has jumped on an airplane, I believe, this weekend, like he's the rest of his 2025 UAE Team Emirates teammates to be. They've flown to Abu Dhabi, where they're having their traditional sort of end of season debrief, but also talking about next year. There's a lot of practical stuff that has to be arranged at these end of season camps. No bike riding generally. But over the next week, they'll be down there. Obviously, the Grand Tour routes have not been released yet. And the first of those to be released will be the Tour de France, and that will be next week. So I don't think they will be able to define with too much certainty which races he's going to ride next year. However, Rob, sitting here now, 21st of October, what is going to be Tadej Pogacar's 2025 race programme, please?
Some classics, including Milano San Remo. Maybe not a Paris-Nice or a Tirreno, because he's tended to shy away from that on a couple of occasions. Maybe a UAE tour, which could be big for the sponsors. Maybe that's something that he's still left to go and do without looking at his palmarès.
Has he won that?
Yeah, maybe not bother him with that one then. But he's in the business, isn't he, of ticking off those lines that he's not achieved yet. So I think Tour de France is difficult for him not to go to, obviously, because of the fact that it's the biggest race going. He's going to go to Vuelta next year, isn't he? He's going to try and win the Vuelta España. But just to go back to what you said about, you know, not able to decide. Yeah, I think the biggest stars nowadays are almost in negotiations, aren't they, with the race organisers on the sort of back channels, on the quiet. Somebody from somewhere, not necessarily the stars themselves, but they're talking. They sort of know. They will roughly know what the routes are going to be before they've been announced, so they can make their decisions. I think the same will be happening with Vingegaard. There were a few rumours in the Italian press last week about Jonas Vingegaard. Oh, he's going to come and do the Giro. I can see Pogacar going back to the Giro, but not next year. I think the Vuelta is something that he wants to win first. And Paris-Roubaix, we'll have to see about that one. Maybe not next year.
Just on the routes, we do know a little bit about what the routes are going to look like. Of course, we know that the Giro d'Italia is going to start in Albania next year. We're expecting three stages in Albania. And then I think, if I remember rightly, I saw an interview with Marovegna a few days ago. They're coming back to Italy via Puglia.
Yeah, over the Adriatic, just hopping over.
Yes. We don't know too much else about what the mountain stages are going to be. There have been various rumours in the local press. Much more sort of meat on the bone as far as the Tour de France is concerned. There are websites that, well, they make it their business to sort of uncover the whole Tour de France route ahead of time. We're hearing that there might be a mountain time trial in the Pyrenees. We're expecting Mont Ventoux. We're expecting the Col de la Loge, which of course was Tadej Pogacar's bete noire a couple of years ago. And we're expecting at the Vuelta a España a start in Piedmont in the northeast of Italy, 3 days there with some hilly stages. But Rob, nothing obvious in, as I said, those sort of rumours that would incline, nothing that makes us think immediately, automatically, Vingegaard will go to that one rather than that one. We're thinking more in terms of where they're at in their career and what they still have to accomplish and want to accomplish, aren't we?
This year we had the extra climbing in the Tour. We had the strange different finish, didn't we, in the sort of the meeting of the big four, you know, for the first time. Next year, I suppose, paths could separate a little bit more. We don't know what Primoz Roglic and Remco Evenepoel are going to do. Evenepoel keeps us guessing, doesn't he? But I don't think we're getting noises from any particular race organisers.
I think Pog will maliciously ruin Rog's party by poop his party by going to the Tour of Switzerland and winning that. Because we know that is one race that Primoz Roglic wants to win.
Yeah.
And you would expect him to have a good chance there. But not if Pog decides that he wants a trip to Switzerland, a trip to buy some Rivella. Anyway, sorry, go on, Rob. Sorry, I interrupted.
I think the noises we're hearing from the organisers, and you mentioned, you know, I think the VeloWire is the big website that often gets the tour route. No, they get 80-90%, I would guess, every year of at least, and we don't see the routes, do we? But we get the towns, and yet the places you suggested are all on there.
Very helpful for hotel booking. Yeah.
Again, we're not 100% sure, but we certainly know the first three stages. They're going to be up in the north, in Lille, and we've already been told there's sort of no cobbles, really, or anything like that, no trips into Belgium. It's going to be sort of French Flanders rather than Flanders. Just no noises from any of the big organisers about particular, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to have this special.
I don't think any of that is going to happen. So for that reason, it's difficult to sort of connect any rider based on ability or particular speciality to any race.
So we don't know.
No.
We don't know.
No. Well, we filled 5 minutes there, haven't we?
Yeah, we did, just about. I expect Pogacar to do the Tour and the Vuelta. I don't know about Vingegaard. I think Vingegaard might... He might have a go at the Giro, especially they were pretty fatalistic. They were pretty defeatist, weren't they? The Visma Lease Bike camp at the end of the Tour de France about future years. If Pogacar maintains the level that he showed this year, then I think Vingegaard might decide that it would be a good idea to try the Giro d'Italia, and the Giro d'Italia should suit him even more than the Tour de France.
And it suits the Giro to have somebody like that there.
Yes. Rob, final question. As regards the off-season, what is your, Rob Hatch's, favourite thing about the off-season? What's your least favourite thing, Rob?
Least favourite thing is like this week now or the 2 weeks afterwards where, and it's a bit like...
This is our summer, Rob.
Well...
These are the salad days.
I love it. I'll go on to my favourite things in a minute, but the least favourite thing is like the week after a Grand Tour or an Olympic Games or something like that where every ounce of your energy has gone into... You know, trying to do your best job and concentrating on that, and then suddenly, sort of, your body doesn't know what to do with itself. Your mind doesn't know what to do with itself. In the evening, it's all right because the football's on. Netflix makes a reappearance. I start to read books again, which is something that I don't really have time to do in the season. But it's like a slow progression into that. I can't just stop. So bizarrely, Daniel, last week when
you
I was ill,
Giro d'Italia preparation.
Not quite this year. I normally start with that. This year, I started the sort of. The other document, which is the research of riders' transfers and things like that. And
what if you get sacked in the winter?
Thanks, man. I don't know. That's why you have to have contract negotiations.
What a waste of time that would all be.
It would be, wouldn't it? Yeah. Trust me, I'm that level-headed that I've had those worrisome thoughts in the years before. But the best thing, Daniel, the best thing about the winter is, yes, when you do get into that research, it sounds pretty sad that, but... I generally combine it with like me and you have done this before, Tour de France before, and training camp. You get to do loads of bike riding and running, exercise. Last year, I took myself off to my beloved Canary Islands for 3.5 weeks. I loved that. Ate some nice food, rode my bike a lot, and I just did a lot of work and felt good going into the new season. There's a few events and things to go to. I have an event to go to in London in a few weeks' time, quite a big one. And then the Track Champions League for me as well is sort of a little bit more work before Christmas. I know you'll be following that.
I was going to say my least favourite thing about the off-season is track cycling.
Indoor cycling, as you call it. In the Velo Ball.
Yes.
No, I love the Track Champions League. Good fun, travelling around. It's a fun event. And I think this year it's 3 weekends long. We're going to Paris. We're then going to a new venue in Apeldoorn in the Netherlands and then to London for the sort of traditional doubleheader finish. So that'll be good. And then I guess I'll really try and have some time off, yeah. And like you said, just get my head down. I think training camp might have to be moved to January this year. But we'll have to see.
What are your goals for the off-season?
Lose a few kilos. just enjoy it again. We're so lucky to do what we do, aren't we? Let's not pretend we've got proper jobs, eh? You know, there are people with real worries every day, but you know, we love it, but we work hard at it, so it is nice to have a chance.
Confronting real life is difficult, isn't it? It's difficult at the end of every Grand Tour. I was talking to a few people the weekend about this, how it becomes a great excuse when you're working on Grand Tours in particular, but throughout the season, it becomes a great excuse not to deal with anything else, any of the other mundane things that most normal people have to deal with on a kind of rolling, everyday basis. And
that reminds me, tomorrow... Don't let me forget to pay the council tax. I've got to do that before I go away.
Yeah.
Holidays first, Daniel. Holidays to Istanbul next week. How about that?
Oh, lovely, lovely. Your favourite? One of your favourite cities?
One of my favourite cities in the world, yeah. Love the place.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by MAP.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Well, Rob, not time to jet off to the easternmost extreme of Europe, westernmost extreme of Asia yet. Because a little bit of work still to do for you, unfortunately, my old mucker. Rob, in
what's
this
well, tell
Rob,
me, tell
in
me.
This final part of today's podcast, we're going to be talking about anniversaries.
Right.
We're going to be talking about two anniversaries. We'll get onto the second one in
one
just
more important than the other.
Yes, we'll get onto the more important one in just a moment. But around well, this off season marks the 10th anniversary of you and I, or you moving in to live with me and us creating what we affectionately and no one else affectionately refer to as the home of cycling.
We got in trouble for that. We got a letter from Eurosport lawyers, didn't
did we really that yeah. really could have got you sacked. Yes, Rob, we 10 years ago we started a fairly lengthy spell of living together, a pair of sort of bachelors in our 30s at the time, weren't we? Those heady days. A lot of talk about cycling back in those days. Still a lot of talk about cycling whenever we're together. I often come and visit you in Mallorca nowadays, but we did live together for over a year, a couple of years in West London. Now, we are going to commemorate this tomorrow.
Listeners, by the way, I've only just found out about this.
No. I was going to say for the benefit of some of our lucky listeners. I'm not sure benefit is quite the right word. Rob, friends of the cycling podcast will be able to join us tomorrow night for an hour and a half of cycling related conversation. They'll be able to ask us questions about cycling, our jobs in cycling, and they'll be able to do this virtually. And wow, I believe Lionel has already told our listeners how to do this, how to participate, and that is by becoming a friend of the cycling podcast. Find all the details, as Lionel has already told you, on the cyclingpodcast.supportingcast.fm. We will be kicking off tomorrow at 8 o'clock Central European Time. We'll be together in Mallorca. That's 7 p.m. UK time.
Before the bill comes on. So, yeah,
yes,
good.
It's about the middle of the afternoon.
Afternoon's round.
In the United States. We have a lot of listeners in the United States. And if you live sort of east of here, you're probably fortunate enough to miss out.
You have to be a dirty stopper, aren't you, on Tuesday night?
On our second Kilometre Zero live, we did one with Joe Dombrowski and Larry Warbass earlier in the year, and it was enjoyed by most who attended. I should also say that we will be recording tomorrow's Shamblecast and releasing it on our feed, and it will be accessible to friends of the podcast. It will be a Kilometre Zero live special episode. So that is the first anniversary I wanted to mention in this part. Rob, second anniversary I wanted to mention is a 20th, not a 10th, a 20th anniversary. And this particular one is going to be celebrated this week by British Cycling, the British Cycling Federation, because it's 20 years since the advent of what they refer to as the British Cycling Endurance Academy. Now, a lot of people who have listened to us over the years and have followed professional cycling over the years will be familiar with this denomination, because they will know that this was something that spawned some incredible sort of generation defining, in terms of British cycling, future altering talent. Six riders were initially selected for what was supposed to be a sort of development under 23 style program. It was 2004, a time when at its best, British cycling or Britain would produce three or four riders who would compete in races like the Tour de France or editions. There was one edition of the Tour de France around about that time. Was it 2005, where there were no British representatives at all? So Britain, Great Britain, the UK, was very much a cycling backwater. Rod Ellingworth, who later became a familiar name as part of the Sky organisation, he then went to Bahrain Victorious. Latterly, he's been helping out with the organisation of the Tour of Britain, but next year he's going back to Bahrain Victorious to help Lenny Martinez get ready for the Tour de France, and their Tour de France team sort of take shape. He was the mastermind of this academy. He was very much, well, he was one of the people responsible for picking the six riders who were initially going to be part of this academy and shaping it, forming up, coming up with a concept, an idea of how they were going to work and how they were going to become elite cyclists. We, Rob, are going to be revisiting the foundation, the genesis of the British Cycling Academy in a special Kilometre Zero that's going to be available to friends of the podcast, and that's going to be released in about 10 days, 2 weeks Brilliant. From now. And in that, you're going to hear from Rod Ellingworth, a lot from him, but you're also going to hear from some of the other riders who were in that initial cohort and a couple of others who were in the following year's cohort. And we're going to tell the story of how it came to be. And this extraordinary, extraordinary story. Rob, you mentioned football earlier in the podcast. There's a famous narrative has been built around the Manchester United team of the 90s. There was a film made about them. It was called The Class of 92, featuring players like the Neville brothers, Paul Scholes, David Beckham, Ryan Giggs. I would put it to you, I would suggest to you, Rob, that this group of six, which became seven, particularly this first intake of riders, is a story much more remarkable than the Class of 92 and Manchester United in football. Three of those riders, three of the initial seven, Ed Clancy, Mark Cavendish, Geraint Thomas.
Wow.
Between them, well, they all lived in a student house in Manchester. We're going to hear Rod talk about that in just a moment. Ed Clancy, 3 Olympic golds, 1 bronze, 8 world records, 6 world titles. Mark Cavendish, we know his palmarès, we don't need to go over it, but 35 Tour de France stage wins, world title, Olympic medals. Geraint Thomas, 2 Olympic golds, 3 world titles, a Tour de France title. All of them selected in the autumn of 2004 and set on the path to greatness.
A bit more talented than our house share, wasn't it?
But yes, it certainly was.
A few more titles
there. It certainly was. So as I said, in the special Kilometre Zero that we're going to release in a couple of weeks, don't know whether we'll call it the Likely Lads, the Young Ones, the Class of 2004, but you're going to hear from several of these riders and you're going to hear from Rod Ellingworth. I'm going to give you a little bit of a teaser of that episode. Now, here is Rod Ellingworth talking about that first class at the British Cycling Academy, how he picked them, who they were, and some of the ground rules that he laid down in those first few weeks.
So there were 6 lads on the first intake. 5 was who came on early, and then Geraint joined later. Geraint was one who, you know, he'd already been junior world champion. He'd already sort of been at that sort of level. So we knew he was coming in, but his parents were very keen that he finished his schoolwork to a certain point and then could come up and join. So, you know, and I'd seen Geraint, a friend of mine, Tim Booker, who was one of the talent team coaches, asked me to come along and watch the National Track Champs one. He said, you need to see this kid. And we watched him doing the individual pursuit as a schoolboy. And I just watched him head on. I was stood on one of the bankings and I was, bloody hell, the way he's pedaling, the way he's dead narrow in the shoulders. He just looked fantastic on the bike. So you knew he had something quite special. There was Bruce Edgar. Again, junior, I think he was national champion. His brother was Ross Edgar, sprinter. And Bruce had a hell of a turn of speed. Like, you know, a 20, 30 second belt. He was phenomenal. But his dedication was a bit off. You know, he was a bit wayward with his thinking. Big talent, you know. Obviously, Cav. And again, you know, somebody like Cav was somebody, as a junior, I just saw him winning so much, yet never went to junior worlds. Never seemed to get on with British cycling. So I was like, why is this? And it was more just because of his character, chirpy lad. People didn't like somebody answering back, and he just didn't get on with people, and I didn't think that was a good enough reason not to take him, quite honestly. He was winning so much, yet never went to junior worlds. I think it was crazy. Then there was Ed Clancy. Again, through talent team, through junior program, the turn of speed on this guy. Ed was a hard one to crack in terms of just getting to know him, you know, very quiet, very much on his own, but you could just see absolutely huge talent in there, you know. Bramia, national champion as a junior, could talk the game streetwise, could sell you anything. But, you know, again, just good character, fitted really well. Big mates with Cav, which, you know, I thought at first, oh my God, these two are going to cause me havoc. But deliberately didn't put them in the same house because I thought, I mean, they weren't far away. So I knew they were going to cause havoc anyway. But to be fair to them both, yes, they caused some havoc, but nothing that I wasn't expecting. And didn't have that many issues with them. And then there was Tom White. Again, as a junior, really talented. Again, on the track, real big turn of speed. Hadn't done much on the road in beforehand, but was fairly talented. On Christian Varley, another Isle of Man lad. This was a bit of a punt, actually, on Christian. Hadn't done much on the track. Had done fairly well on the road. Had quite a decent engine on him. And it was just one of these, a little bit of a gamble to try something quite different. But it was quite evident Christian, after a few months left, he just wasn't cut out for it. He didn't like the routine, didn't like the regimented. You know, it was pretty tough that first year, I've got to say. I think they had the hardest time, I think. We were all finding our feet. I was trying to find my feet. I wasn't that old really, and I was trying to find my feet. Right, what's the level to be at? What level of discipline and everything do you put in? So before we did the academy, I went off and visited quite a few different sports of the similar age groups. I wanted to learn, like, what. So I went to boxing, I went to ballet, I went to British athletics, I went to a few different sports, a couple of other Olympic sports, like winter sports and that, just to sort of see they've got in-house, you know, they bring the kids in for periods of time. How do the coaches deal? And it was really good listening to all these different people. So I was forming all my ideas. I was looking at what the AIS were doing. You know, I'd looked and studied as much as I could on the old East German Russian system of how they were all living in schools. They're all in sports schools. What was that like? And tried to talk to people on that. Heiko being one who I spoke to a lot on that sort of thing. But one of the biggest influences was Dave Miller. And I spoke to Dave. You know, he was in his middle of his troubles and everything. In the middle of it, if you think. And he said to me, do you know, the worst thing you can do is isolate these kids where they won't be able to go out. They won't be able to socialise. And I was like, bloody hell, mate, totally agree with you. Because for me, cycling was about socialising. You know, I was always involved in clubs. And, you know, our house as a young kid was like the cycling house where all the kids used to come around and watch cycling. And, you know, it was all cycling. And I loved being around the dinner table on races, stage races, talking about the day's racing and everything. So I was like, yeah, absolutely. And he said, if I was you, I'd put them up in the university area in Manchester. Straight away, I just thought, what a great idea. And that's what we did. They were living in not very nice places, quite frankly, but they were right in the heart of Fallowfield in Manchester. To start off with, in two normal houses, and I split them up. For me, you wanted them to go out. They're young lads. They're going to go out. They want to go meet people, relationships, whatever they want to go do. They want to go have a beer. They want to go to a nightclub, whatever they need to do. But they had to be at the track at 7:30 in the morning. You know, if they weren't at the track at 7:30 in the morning, then there's a problem. If they turned up pissed, there'd be a problem. This was all about them having their responsibility, you know, and being accountable for turning up and everything else. I hardly had any problems. Hey, and the other thing was, I was always like, right, guys, if you've been out on the Razzle, ring me and tell me you've been out on the Razzle and you're not going to make it. If you're puking up or whatever, ring me. Don't hide it, because the worst thing you can do is try and turn up and do a session and you're not very good. And then you get sick. I said, we're all in this together. And I tell you, I never hardly had any problems. I had a couple of lads ring me and just say, oh, so I was out last night, met a girl, whatever it may be. Can't make it in, you know, I'm not actually home. Okay, you know, have you done your whereabouts or whatever they need to do? You know, I didn't mind. We just got on with it. If we'd have put them out in the middle of an hour out, they're going to go out. They're going to get a taxi in. It's going to cost them money. It's going to take longer. I just wanted them in the heart of Manchester. But that the whole idea of university area came from Dave Miller.
Rob, what a story it is. What a story. And, you know, such a privilege. And anyone who listens to that episode when, as I say, we release it in a couple of weeks, if they don't already know, they will be able to sort of measure the passion and the sort of ingenuity as well that Rob Ellingworth brought to that role. And when you do listen to Rob, talk and some of the ideas that he implemented there, you can't really go away feeling that it was just happenstance, it was just a case of bottling lightning, and it was just three, four, five incredible talents that came together at the same time. A big part of it was the way that Rod Ellingworth put that program together, mm-hmm. British Cycling put that program together, and it was a moment in time that would never be repeated, will never be repeated, although the academy did go on to produce other successful riders.
You listen to Rod, and he's such a tremendous talker and a really engaging person to listen to, isn't he? And it's no wonder that he was able to get people on side, whether it be young athletes who maybe were desperate for a night out in Manchester rather than going training, but you know, everybody was talked round, was brought on side, or the staff who were working with him, the managers who were going to have to allocate the funding and logistics people, he would have had them captivated, because he still has us 20 years later talking about it. And a really, really interesting listen. And I was just listening to you put some of it together in the background. I was having lunch before, and you know, I just couldn't help. I was doing my own things on the computer. I just couldn't help but drift away and listen to Rod, because he's such an interesting listen. And with regards to that flat share, dearie me, I mean, if this was any other sport, you know, certainly if it was something like football, athletics, something like that, it'd be all over the world, that sort of stat, wouldn't it? Incredible. Has there ever been a collection of students living together like that before? Maybe at some posh American university with some scholarships and things, but wow, absolutely, what a story.
Indeed, Rob. We'll be back next week. You will not be joining me, but we'll be talking about the Tour de France route, which will have been freshly unveiled, unsheathed. I think it's Tuesday, is it, Rob?
The 29th. Route presentation. Yes, Tuesday.
Well, soon afterwards, in the hours thereafter, we will be going live with our thoughts in the podcast about the 2025 Tour de France route.
I listened to it on my holidays. How about that?
Tremendous. We'll see you all then. And to an unfortunate few, we will
all five
see
of you. We'll see you tomorrow.
We'll see you tomorrow evening. Look forward to it. Thank you, Rob.
Cheers.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.